you're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Wednesday, so we are back with our medical experts to answer your questions about COVID-19. So if you have one, get it into us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Laura McGeorge, St. Luke's Health System Medical Director, and Dr. Mark Nasser, President of the St. Alphonsus Medical Group. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, Gemma.
Thank you, Gemma.
Absolutely. So I want to start with a listener. I'm not sure if everyone remembers Christina. We heard from her about 2 weeks ago, right here on Idaho Matters. The first day the state opened up vaccines to folks 65 and older, she struggled online and by phone to try to get an appointment.
I'm just going to continue watching and try off and on several times a day until I can get an appointment, because otherwise I'm in isolation until I can have the vaccine.
Well, some good news to report. She wrote us to tell us that she was able to schedule her first vaccine shot with Salter's Medical Meridian Clinic. However, we have heard from so many people, they are frustrated, who have not been able to sign up for the vaccine yet. Now, Kathy is a listener. She says she's been trying to get an appointment online with St. Luke's through St. Luke's MyChart. John wrote in that he had an appointment with St. Alphonsus, but it was canceled, and then he had to start the process all over again. We also heard from Amanda, who has been in isolation with her two very young children for 10 months. God bless you, Amanda. And Michael, who are both willing to be on standby to take any extra vaccine left behind at a moment's notice. We also heard from both Cindy and Sue, who want to know what day vaccine shipments come into our state so they don't have to check and recheck websites every single day for new appointments to open up. We know that is just a small example of how many frustrated people are out there who listen to our show. So I want to focus on one person, Jean, because she's got some questions that I think a lot of people have. She says her husband is over 65. They've been trying to get him the vaccine. She says there is a lot of misinformation out there about how to register to get a vaccine. So Dr. McGeorge, with all that being said, I want to start with you. Can you tell us how people sign up with St. Luke's to get a vaccine?
Thank you, Gemma. Yes. So a couple of things. There's actually a little bit I want to unpack there too.
Yeah, I know, right?
Right. A couple of things. So yes, I understand and also hear people's frustration every day. And I do think to the first listener comment that you had, that person was able to schedule a vaccine. I do think that people are starting to maybe start to see a little bit of sunshine here in things getting better as there is more vaccine and more organizations across the state that can provide the vaccine. That being said, St. Luke's knows it remains incredibly difficult and frustrating for patients and people across the communities that we serve. And so we are working, meeting every day of the week, really, to try to make things better and better. So let me explain what the current process is, but I'd also like to throw in where we continue to meet some challenges so people can really understand why this is not quite as easy as it seems. So current state at St. Luke's, there's no doubt the best way, the most efficient way to get an appointment is through MyChart. We are, and that app, you know, is on your phone or mm-hmm. you can do it on your computer. There's information on the St. Luke's website, how to get a MyChart account. If you don't have one, you do not have to be a St. Luke's patient to get a MyChart account. We also, by the way, absolutely recognize and are very concerned about people who are unable to access through technology and are looking for ways that we can reach out to those more vulnerable people in the community. So we're working on that too. So best way, again, is through MyChart. We are working on ways to make it more obvious whether or not we have openings. Generally our experience has been when we open appointments, they're gone in minutes. We can open 1500 appointments and they're gone in minutes. And so clearly that indicates the supply and the demand come nowhere near to matching. I think everyone is aware that that's an issue.
Go ahead.
The only other thing I want to really point out that's important for people to know is we still do not have solid, consistent, predictable inventory. Mm. And that is tremendously important for planning as well as just posting appointments. So we started out with maybe half Pfizer, half Moderna. Well, suddenly now, we're getting much less Moderna because that is going to other providers in the state, and that's okay. But to operationalize that is tremendously difficult. And so now we have a clinic, for example, that's giving half our Moderna boosters as we're phasing that out. But now we're bringing in Pfizer initial doses, and then those will have to follow up with Pfizer. So it's just incredibly complicated work. And so what St. Luke's stance has been is we are not opening appointments until we really are able to validate that we will have vaccine in hand. And so through the week, as things are evolving so quickly, we open up appointments where we can ensure that we do in fact have vaccine either in hand or absolute confirmation that it will be showing up in the St. Luke's freezers. So then one other thing that we are doing is we are giving a little head start as much as we can to those that are a little bit older, like 75 and up. And that was direction really from the health districts, although initially the tier really is 65 and up, there was a request to try to at least provide some opportunity for those who are even more vulnerable than 65 years old people in general, and those would be 75 and up people. So all of those things are actions that we are doing to try to make sure that we can get vaccine into arms. Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Nasser, how about St. Alphonsus when it comes to folks signing up?
Thanks, Gemma. It's an honor to be with you and with our listeners again today. Just to update overall how things are going at St. Alphonsus, and also specifically to answer your question about sign up for vaccination. Mm-hmm. I'll just start with that. The best source of information and the easiest way to sign up is through our website, www.stalphonsus.org/get-vaccinated. And that website, which can be linked from the main St. Alphonsus page, takes you to the wealth of information about the vaccine and the latest information on how to sign up and our location to receive the vaccine. In a very similar manner, we've seen a decrease in the number of admitted cases at St. Alphonsus, which we're all very thankful for, both admitted to the general hospital ward, but also decrease in numbers to the ICU. We are just really putting our weight of effort behind the vaccination mm-hmm. surge that initially started at multiple hospitals and at several of our outpatient clinics. But we're very excited to announce that starting tomorrow on February 18th, we'll be consolidating our vaccination effort to a very high throughput, large-scale vaccination clinic in Meridian. And the information on that also can be found at the website in a space that's going to allow really large numbers of patients to safely park and gather in an orderly fashion to get vaccinated. And so the sign up for that is on the website. There is also a toll-free number to assist those patients who maybe need that not as well to be able to sign up through the website. And that's 1-888-578-2684. And all of this information is also posted on the website, but that's the easiest way to sign up.
Right. And that streamlined, that mass vaccination clinic, it's the old Gordman's, if people are wondering where it is. It's in the Village in Meridian area, right there off of Eagle Road. I think it's fair to say, and I think it's important to say, that this is a supply issue. This is not about the hospitals, the health clinics not doing their jobs. And with that being said, though, Dr. Pate, the state held a news conference yesterday and saying that we were going to be getting more doses. In fact, I believe about an extra 5,000 doses a week will go to retail pharmacies, so Albertsons and Walmarts in particular. So that's good news in the sense that we will be getting upwards of 30,000 doses a week. In fact, one state official said that we will not ever get less than 25,000 doses a week. And I know that sounds like good news. It's also good news that people want to get the vaccine. However, what do we need to do from a state level to try to get more? Because we're still behind other states and quite a few other states, Dr. Pate.
Well, you're right, Gemma. There is some good news ahead, and there's even more good news. So the first thing is what you just mentioned, is that already our state is getting around 25,000 doses a week. I'll just remind people that when this first started, we were getting about 20, 21,000 doses. I will also let you know something that probably most people don't know, and that is the federal partnership with pharmacies where they would go and vaccinate those in our nursing homes, those very vulnerable people, that had to come out of the state allotment. In other words, they didn't get a separate amount to do that. That had to come out of our then 20, 21,000 doses. So that took up quite a bit of the vaccine. It has now increased, as you said, to about 25 to 26,000. In addition, as of last Thursday, there's a new federal retail pharmacy partnership in which pharmacies will be getting doses of vaccine that they can administer. And the good news is that's on top of what the state gets. So it doesn't come out of our 25 or 26,000 doses. And right now it's around 5,000 doses, but President Biden already announced last night that that's going to double soon. In addition, the Biden administration has secured more doses of vaccine, and so we are expecting an additional increase in our vaccine. We haven't been given the date. I don't know the exact number, but it is going to happen, and it's going to happen soon. And then a third piece of good news is that the Janssen vaccine, or Johnson & Johnson vaccine, is going to get a hearing before the FDA on the 26th of this month. And it's very possible that could start being added to our allotments next month. Let me just end by saying something that I understand people are frustrated. I've been frustrated. I totally understand, and it's legitimate. But I do want to emphasize St. Luke's and St. Al's are really stepping up to the plate. They don't have to do this. They've agreed to do this. They're trying to help out. And it is a logistics nightmare, especially as Dr. McGeorge says, when the federal government until recently hadn't even been able to tell them how much vaccine or if they'll get any vaccine is coming or when it's coming. So I understand people being frustrated, but I want everybody to know that St. Luke's and St. Al's are trying to be part of the solution.
Right. And I think that's so important to mention, because, you know, these are the folks that get those frustrated phone calls and all of that. Yeah. We have heard from quite a few parents who are concerned in regards to schools reopening, schools staying closed. In fact, one parent, you know, said, what the CDC guidelines said is, you know, to return to hopefully full time before the end of the school year. Dr. Pate, I am curious about this, because you have have tweeted about this quite a bit this last week, because some of the questions we got is, what do our doctors think about returning to school? Can schools force kids to return to school? And then why aren't vaccinations for parents being considered. So I know there's a lot to get to, Dr. Pate, but can you talk a little bit about where we are in regards to some schools reopening?
Yeah. So what the CDC said and what the Biden administration has said, I agree with. That is, if there are schools out there operating fully remote, they should reopen. I think what a lot of people have done is misinterpreted what they've said to think that reopening means have all children come back for full in person. That's not the same thing. There may be some schools that are capable of having all the students back for full in-person classes, but I haven't seen one yet. And that's, and what is worrisome to me, I know everybody wants kids back in school. I do. I love school and I know how important school is. However, what has been a willingness of some school boards is to say, okay, we're doing well. Cases are on the decline. Hospitalizations are down. We're starting to get the rollout of vaccines. We can now bring all kids back. And for some reason, they're under the impression that we no longer have to have physical distancing. Well, I think that is a very serious mistake. And, you know, there have not been many times during this pandemic that we actually get a preview of coming attractions. Mm-hmm. We got it at the very beginning of the pandemic when we didn't have cases in the United States and we could look at what was happening in China. We're getting another look now. And one only has to look to the UK, Israel, Italy, Denmark, Ireland. There's a number of places that already have this UK variant as their dominant strain. And what people are missing is it's not just a more contagious form of what we've had. It has completely different transmission characteristics. And while it is true that up till now, with the variants we've had here in Idaho, we haven't had any significant in-person transmission. That is not what they're experiencing in Europe. They did experience that before, but what they're seeing now that B117 is prominent is they are seeing the highest attack rate is in children 5 to 9 years old. That's very different than what we've dealt with. And they now are seeing evidence that in fact, schools are contributing to community spread. So my argument is, let's continue operating in hybrid. Let's get kids distanced. Let's have as many kids as we safely can back in school, but let's not bring everybody back and forget distancing. If you listen to the UK, their primary warning is distance, distance, distance. They've had great trouble containing this UK variant, and they emphasize over and over again the importance of distancing. Now, you may say, or some would say, you wouldn't say this, Gemma, some might say, well, so what if the kids get infected and are at very low risk of getting severe disease? That's true. However, what happens is you look at one village in Italy, Corzano, if you look at their new B117, or that's the UK variant cases, 60% are in kids. Guess who the other 40% are in?
It's in their parents.
Right. Their parents. And what happens is the CDC has already told us this is going to be the dominant strain in March, sometime in March. Guess what? We're not going to have all our high-risk folks vaccinated by then. We're currently vaccinating 65 and above. They're not going to be all vaccinated by then. Also, we don't even get to those that are under 65 with many health conditions that put them at high risk until probably at least April or May. So it's going to be too late. And what's going to happen, and I don't think people are prepared for this, we are going to have an explosion of cases here. and we're not prepared for it. And what is foolish about some of the school decisions is, in an interest to try to get all the kids back, what we're going to do is jeopardize the possibility of having school for any, because we're going to have widespread outbreaks, and now everybody's going to have to go to remote. And I don't think that's the best outcome.
And I do want to make it clear, Dr. Pate, because I've seen some people making this argument about, well, private schools can open, why can't public schools? In full disclosure, and we've talked about this on this program, my children go to a private school. Yes, they are back in school full time. With that said, it is not fully in person, because they have to keep distance and they have to keep the class sizes down. So they have used auxiliary classrooms. They have taken over other spaces so that these kids can be in school. But my middle schooler, upwards of 3 to 4 of his classes a day are remote. He's on the school grounds, but it's still remote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's important to make that difference, that people understand that.
It is. And certainly, as you're saying, I'm not against all kids returning to school. What I'm against is having all kids return to school and not have them distanced. So if there are schools like your schools that have found ways to, because they have more space, they brought in temporary buildings, they brought in tents, whatever it is, I think there's ways to do it. But if schools are going to try to double up the number of students that they have right now, and I've gone and done walkthroughs through 5 schools, 2 elementary, 1 middle, 2 high schools, and I haven't found a school yet that can successfully distance even in hybrid. And we can get away with it with the variants that we've had. What Europe is telling us, we won't get away with it with the UK strain. And I just think we're foolish to not be planning ahead, especially when this can cause a very big problem for us. We're on the home stretch.
Right.
And frankly, I don't know that it's even feasible, but I've even suggested, do we consider doing this until spring break, and then maybe have spring break until the summer, and then restart classes to finish up the year? At least that would buy us time to get more people vaccinated. That may be a crazy idea, but I think right now we got to think of other ideas besides just bring all the kids back and don't worry about distancing and then let this virus run loose.
Dr. Nasser, we just got 2 questions in regarding the new clinic that will be opening out on Eagle Road, the old Gordman's building. So William wrote in and wanted to know, will both the first and second shots be given at this new location? And then, because Anne said that she wrote in and she says she has an appointment this Friday for her second COVID shot that was originally scheduled at the Curtis Road location at St. Alphonsus. So she wants to know, does she still go there or has everything been streamlined to Meridian?
Yeah, thank you, Gemma. So for William and for your additional caller, the answer is exactly as the question asked, is to take that appointment will be now rescheduled at the new location, which will be in Meridian. So all previously scheduled appointments starting tomorrow and forward, the location for that appointment, the appointment is still valid, but the location for the appointment will be at the new high throughput center at the former Gordman's in the village in Meridian. And patients should be notified. They have been and are being notified of the location change for their appointment. But if they haven't received that, I appreciate the ask for clarification.
And Dr. McGeorge, several people have written in wanting to know if there's some type of master list that they can get on to get any leftover vaccine at a moment's notice. We've all heard of those anecdotal stories, right? Like, oh my gosh, I was at the pharmacy and they had doses left over and I got one. Do we have a list like that that we know of?
We don't. You know, we started by trying to put together a list like that, and extremely quickly we had about 5,000 people on the list. When I say extremely quickly, I mean probably within about 2 days. And the likelihood, you know, if we just kept adding to that list, the likelihood of getting called is just minute. The other thing that has happened, I will say, is earlier on when we were vaccinating, and especially before we opened up to 65 and up. So when we were in the earlier tiers, we were just learning about the vaccine, absolutely had those kind of situations where we get to the end of the day and we have, you know, 3 more doses mm-hmm. left in a Pfizer or 7 more doses in a Moderna. But we're actually getting better and better at predicting even midway through the day where we're going to run into issues and pulling people off of, allowing people who have a future appointment to move up their appointment through something we call Fast Pass. Also reaching out to people that were on that original wait list of 5,000 and trying to get them in so that really by the end of the day, there's very little to some days, nothing left. It is the other thing that's happening is it is pretty unusual that we turn someone away when they are there. But I will say the main reason that we turn people away is that they have had a different vaccine within 2 weeks. And really the CDC guidance is to hold off on a COVID vaccine if you've had another vaccine. So that's becoming less of a problem, but we still see that from time to time and then have to ask someone to reschedule.
Dr. Nestor, we've had some questions like this one come up. What underlying health issues prioritize a person's place in line? One person wrote in saying, I've been told that metastatic cancer is not considered an underlying condition.
So the CDC has published some guidance to help hospitals and clinics discern what would be considered a higher risk for severe illness from COVID. And indeed, cancer is number one on that list. And severe illness or higher risk for severe illness would be a hospitalization or admission to the ICU or the need for assistance for breathing and additional respiratory support. So examples for higher risk, and these are listed on the CDC guidance through their website and through their other published guidance, but it would include cancer, kidney disease, chronic disease of the lungs, other diseases of the heart, obesity has been identified, severe obesity, and other chronic diseases that one might imagine which would put patients at risk. And so as we do go to vaccinate, we want to be cautious and deliberate about being aware of patients in the community and their underlying conditions as we try to help facilitate, you know, getting them scheduled for their vaccinations. And that's part of that most vulnerable patient, you know, outreach that we mentioned earlier in the program and that we're trying to support our patients as well in that manner.
And then before we go to break, another listener just wrote in wanting to know about taking some type of medication like Tylenol or a pain reliever after you get the vaccine. Because Dr. McGeorge, I believe we've read that you shouldn't take something like that before you get your vaccine.
Yes. So that's right. Hold off on pre-medicating, so to speak, before your vaccine. And then after the vaccine, you may take Tylenol or ibuprofen or Aleve if you need it. And again, of course, always caution, especially with the ibuprofen and Aleve, that caveat is as long as you're able to take it for other reasons. So for example, if you're on a blood thinner, most people on blood thinner or with chronic kidney disease are not supposed to be taking those meds anyway. So of course we wouldn't want them taking them after the vaccine. Most people do fine with the vaccine without those medications, but some people find that they do need them, particularly after the booster.
Dr. Pate, Krista wrote in, what about childhood vaccinations and babies? Where are we with trials, and when might children be vaccinated?
So Pfizer has fully enrolled its trial, but that's for children age 12 to 15. After that, then the next step will be children 5 to 11, and that is expected to be later this year. The reason for not just testing all kids is teenagers are different than the younger kids, and we have to look at different dosing, different considerations. So that does need to be a separate trial. We have to be prepared for the fact that it's possible we won't get authorization for under 11 years old until next year. And that is concerning with the UK variant coming, which seems to have more proclivity for younger kids. Moderna, unfortunately, hasn't been able to fully enroll its study of 12 to 17 year olds. They're just not getting enough volunteers. And that's a real shame because even if we can get Pfizer approved, as we all have seen, having two vaccines or more helps with the amount of vaccine available. So unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get kids, at least kids that are teenagers, eligible to be vaccinated until probably this summer or late summer.
Mm-hmm. And then it'll go from there, as you said, Dr. Pate, because then
it will
have to do those trials. Okay. Dr. McGeorge, Sue has three questions. She wants to know, if vaccines are said to be 94% effective, what does that mean? Can someone still get a bad case and die? And how should we consider our safety with these mutations?
Yeah, okay. So three questions there. Yeah. So 94% effective. Really, in the studies, what that means is that if you compared the group of people that were vaccinated compared with the group that were not, 94% of people were protected from getting COVID compared to people who were not vaccinated. So super highly effective in really, frankly, getting sick at all from COVID. And that really are the our Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. So what's really important about that is obviously that is tremendously protective, better than most vaccines that we have, significantly better than the influenza vaccine. But another key thing to keep in mind is that they are even more protective against getting a severe case. And I think, you know, there are a couple of things we think about, and what a lot of what Dr. Pate has been talking about too, you know, with kids and getting the vaccine, the biggest concern with kids is we don't want them to spread COVID. We know that they, in general, don't get as sick from it, but the most important thing is that they are spreading it. So having a vaccine that keeps you from getting a severe case is super, super important. But then having vaccine to keep you from getting any COVID is obviously also really important. So as far as the variants go, I actually do have a couple of comments about the variants that I'd like to make. So one of them is, for, you know, at this time, we do have great confidence in our vaccines. Again, the key thing with the vaccines are that they are preventing people from getting severe disease, disease as defined as hospitalization or death. And so the vaccines are still very effective against the variants. This is being monitored. And, you know, if we think about influenza, we know that we sometimes have to have booster vaccines that are slightly different from the original vaccine. And so I would not be surprised if with COVID, it turns out it's one of those diseases that we just periodically have to get boosters as we see changes. One other thing on the variants, though, I do want to emphasize is, although the variants certainly can be more contagious, they still spread the same way. And that same way of spread is really droplet and perhaps some aerosolizing. And so I really want to emphasize the tools we already know about that we have and we are using remain highly effective. And those, again, are the masking, the physical distancing, avoiding large gatherings, particularly large gatherings inside. Those are extremely effective against these variants too. So even though the variants are there, I'm, you know, as long as we do those things, not as concerned. Now, I know we don't all do those things all the time, but I will tell you, you know, from where I work, and, you know, if everyone in society followed things as well as healthcare organizations did, we probably have a lot less COVID out there because, again, you know, in my work every day, we are all just so cautious about PPE, physical distancing, avoiding gatherings. All of my meetings all day long are on Teams just for that reason. So even though it's difficult, again, if we do these things, we can get through this.
Dr. Nasser, Kara has a very interesting question. She says, if I am eligible to get the vaccine because my employer is a medical provider, but I am not in an at-risk demographic and I have had corona without any symptoms, is it better I wait until there are more vaccines available and let at-risk people get the vaccine first?
Well, I just wanted to say, Kara, that's very thoughtful of you. So if you have had confirmed COVID, and that would be not just a suspected, or I might have had exposure or perhaps some mild symptoms and assumed it was COVID, but if you've had confirmed COVID, it's likely that you have some immunity depending on what the exposure was and the timing of how long ago that was. I will say if you do work for a medical organization and you are eligible, it really would be your choice. We do recommend the vaccine to ensure your immunity. And we are recommending that for all eligible categories in accordance with the state categories and trying to walk through that. The demand right now is much larger than the supply. So we've talked a lot about logistics and the challenges of getting increased supply so that we can vaccinate greater numbers in our community. So if you chose yourself to defer to a little bit later for other high-risk Idahoans, that would be very thoughtful as well.
Dr. Pate, this email came in this morning from Peggy, and she writes, on February 3rd, I received my first dose of COVID vaccine. I'll receive my second dose March 3rd. I'm scheduled for a mammogram on March 22nd. I read that it would be best to cancel the mammogram appointment for a month or so after my second COVID shot. I sure would appreciate your opinion.
Yes. Yeah, so what happens is there are a small number of women, but I've seen it happen, that after they get the vaccine in their arm, they get a lot of swelling in the lymph nodes under that arm. That's just part of the normal immune response. Most people won't notice it. But some people, like one case that I've recently seen, get some pretty dramatic swelling of their lymph nodes. Mm. What the concern is that that is one of the things we look for as a sign of bad breast cancer, is if we see enlarged lymph nodes. So it can throw them off and make them be concerned that you have a really severe breast cancer when really all you have is a reaction to the vaccine. So we do I do want to stress the importance of getting your mammograms. That's very, very important. And I'm glad you're going to do that. But we do recommend that you either get it be right before you get your vaccines, or you wait until a month after your second dose. Usually the lymph nodes resolve in even less time, but at a month you should really be fine to go, and it's not going to affect your results.
And then Dr. McGeorge, Deanne had a question regarding vaccination and surgery. She has an outpatient shoulder surgery scheduled for March 8th. And she wants to know how she should plan vaccine timing if it becomes available before or after her surgery.
Well, what I usually recommend to people, so first of all, I think if you have an opportunity to get the vaccine and you are in the state tiers, you're eligible for the vaccine, if you can, I would prioritize the vaccine. And the reason why is because getting COVID pre or post-op is not ideal, obviously. And so again, if you have an option to prioritize the vaccine, that's what I would do. Second is keep in mind after the vaccine, particularly after the booster, you may not feel great for a couple of days. And so you would need to keep that in mind as far as the timing of surgery. And then also it will matter, it will, you know, depend on what kind of surgery you're having. If you are having carpal tunnel surgery and you need to get your booster, if you have carpal tunnel surgery today and you need to get your vaccine next week, I have no doubt you will be able to come in and get your vaccine. If you are having a total knee replacement today, I think you're going to have a lot of trouble coming in next week to get a vaccine. And so again, I think all of those different things need to be taken into consideration. But again, vaccines are very important. So try to prioritize that where it is feasible and reasonable.
Dr. Nasser, Linda wrote in, her mother is in a nursing home and she got her second dose of the vaccine, but then did test positive for COVID with a rapid test. She has no symptoms, but they're being offered for her mom to get them. I hope I'm saying this right. The monoclonal antibody. I can never say that right. And she's wondering, should they do that treatment?
Yeah, this is a great, great question. And really, I would defer the final decision to this patient's physician, primarily taking care of her. I will just make a couple comments. Normally, for the rapid test, the accuracy for that test is most ideal with symptomatic cases or post-exposure. So I think she was asking about the possibility of confirming that with a PCR test, which would really help clarify if this was indeed a positive COVID test. I would say that if this patient is completely asymptomatic and getting farther and farther away from what we think was the day of exposure and doing very well, it would be not clear if the monoclonal antibody is indicated. I think it's presently recommended for certain non-hospitalized patients who have mild to moderate illness. They don't require oxygen. They're not requiring increased, you know, admission to the hospital, and that they have some other risk factors, of which age is a risk factor to consider. But if she's doing very well, it might be a situation to consult with the physician primarily caring for her as to whether or not to take on additional therapy at this time.
And I'm curious, you know, as we continue down this path, Dr. Pate, we've got about a minute left, but Lisa writes in wanting to basically know how in Idaho do we come to herd immunity? And I asked that too, Dr. Pate, because I know you had said recently that we have so many kids in the state of Idaho that that depends on when children get vaccinated, as we talked about earlier.
Well, it does, Gemma, and you're exactly right. That's been my input about this, is that if you look at Idaho, 23.6% of Idahoans are kids. Now, 16 to 18 can currently get a vaccine with the Pfizer. They can't get the Moderna, but they can get the Pfizer. But that's still a significant percentage. When we get the UK variant in here, anytime the disease becomes more transmissible, that increases the level that you need for herd immunity. So it's going to be a while. The way to know, follow the state numbers. When those, right now, those cases are around 20 cases per day. When they get down to one and stay there, then we'll be there.
Fingers crossed. Thank you all so very much for your time, for everything that you are all doing as we continue to move through this process. Appreciate all of you.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, Dr. Laura McGeorge, and Dr. Mark Nasser. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. If you have questions for next week, get them in, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.